You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of January 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House. Coming to you live from Studio One, I'm Tadhg Enright, and here's what's coming up on today's show.
Ukraine needs much, much more help that it's there on the table at the moment. And it seems like IMF or any other country, they are reluctant to provide more, again, because of not enough reforms inside of Ukraine.
Civilian casualties and a renewed battle for control of Donetsk airport has signaled a resurgence in Ukrainian hostilities. Plus, there are growing calls for Europe to throw some euros at Kiev's economic problems. I'll be discussing that and more with our esteemed guests, Jeffrey Kaufman from America's ABC News and Mary Dejevsky from The Independent in London. They'll also join me as we shift our focus to a potential clampdown on internet freedom. Could that be the perverse outcome of the Charlie Hebdo attack on free speech?
I know how carefully this is done, how much paperwork and proper approach has to be taken before anyone listens to anybody else's telephone, but it has saved lives, and it saves lives all the time.
We'll also take a look at how the Arab world is reacting to the latest issue of Charlie Hebdo.
Of course, Arab cartooning is a vast field. There's hundreds of cartoonists working across the Middle East, but generally speaking, Arab and Muslim cartoonists have strongly condemned the murder at Charlie Hebdo.
And before we go, Monocle's Ben Ryland previews some upcoming films with Isabel Stevens from the British Film Institute. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Tadhg Enright. Lots coming up in the next hour here, but before all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the latest world news.
Belgian, French and German police have interrogated dozens of Islamist suspects today as much of Europe remained on a heightened security alert after last week's killings in Paris and raids yesterday in Belgium in which two gunmen were killed in Verviers. Belgium's federal prosecution spokesman Eric van der Zijt said the operation there was successful.
This operation was meant to dismantle a terrorist cell, not only the terrorist cell but also the logistic network behind it. This investigation for the time being has shown that these people had the intention to kill several policemen in the street and at police commissariats.
In Paris, there was a fresh scare when a gunman took several people hostage at a post office. Earlier, the US Secretary of State John Kerry visited the scenes of last week's attacks, which killed 17 people, and laid wreaths in memory of the victims. After meeting the President and the Foreign Minister, he gave a joint press conference with the Mayor of Paris at City Hall.
I want to thank President Hollande, my friend Laurent Fabius, and of course, the Mayor, not only for their always generous welcome, but for the grit and the grace that they have shown at this moment of testing for France.
The Islamic State militant group is reported to have executed 15 people over the past 24 hours in Syria. Some of the victims were shot and crucified, according to the UK-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. In China, a search and rescue operation is still underway on Friday evening after a boat capsized in the Yangtze River, leaving 22 people missing, including foreigners. Three people have been rescued. The South African president, Jacob Zuma, has asked Parliament to reconsider a bill giving the state a free 20% stake in gas and oil ventures, believing it might not survive a potential challenge that it is unconstitutional, the government said. Parliament passed the changes to its main petroleum law last March, alarming companies such as Shell, Total and ExxonMobil, which are looking to explore in South Africa. And finally, Britain's infamous Beagle 2 spacecraft, once dubbed a heroic failure by the nation's Astronomer Royal, has now been found on Mars 11 years after it went missing after its search for extraterrestrial life. Until now, nothing had been heard from it, but today, David Parker, chief executive of the UK Space Agency, told the London's Royal Society's scientific institution that experts have spotted the tiny craft on the surface of the red planet.
What we can say today with some confidence is that Beagle 2 is no longer lost. And further, it seems we are not looking at a crash site. Recently, analysed images from the high-rise instrument of the NASA Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter show good evidence of Beagle 2 resting on the surface of Mars. These images are consistent with Beagle 2 having successfully landed on Mars, but then having only partially deployed itself.
And that's the latest news from Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06. It's 13.06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the day's news here in the studio, I'm joined by Jeffrey Kaufman from ABC News in the United States. Also by Mary Dajewski from the Independent newspaper here in London. Welcome both of you to the programme. First of all, we're going to talk about Ukraine, where 13 people were killed earlier in the week after a bus was hit by what the government called a rebel shell. The airport in the eastern city of Donetsk has also been taken by pro-Russian separatists. For more on that, Monocle's Ben Ryland spoke to the Ukrainian journalist Maxim Erostavi in Kiev a short time ago.
You know, there are two driven forces behind recent spike of violence and collapse in peace talks, and it's strategic and political. And strategically, no rebel-controlled territories, no Crimea doesn't have vital resources to become self-sustainable territories. So what we see here in eastern Ukraine right now is rebels pushing back against the Ukrainian army and trying to regain control over a couple of vital energy and transportation hubs. And you know, the Donetsk International Airport included in this list. Although, you know, after months of Stalingrad-like battle for it, there is anything hardly left which resembles an airport. And that's why we saw a powerful influx of Russian weapons and soldiers in recent weeks, as foreign and Ukrainian journalists report, and actually information is also backed up by local and foreign intelligence. And at this point, we're hearing about 60 to 90 daily exchanges of fire between both sides. And unfortunately, shelling of residential areas has also resumed, and reportedly by both sides, and unfortunately with rising number of civilian casualties.
So you mentioned there that the airport is really a shell of its former self, and of course would have very little strategic importance, but it remains symbolically important. Why is that?
Because right now, this battle is more about securing the outskirts of the biggest eastern Ukrainian city of Donetsk, and not about the airport, because it's in shambles. And also, I think it's flexing muscles, because there is also the biggest question whether or not Russia will try to establish a territorial link to early annexed Crimea, which is at the moment is suffocating economically and its logistic and energy blockade. Also, the Eastern Ukrainian war became a political hostage for both sides, too, with Moscow and Kyiv using more increasing informational warfare to gain political ground. It's, you know, it's the same boat for Russia and Ukraine, with both countries trying to use war mentality and, of course, patriotism surge to divert attention from rapidly deteriorating economic situation. And in Russia, it's sagging national currency and Western sanctions that are hitting home hard. And in Ukraine, this is obviously a pending default in absence of any solid movement towards reform. And I think most likely out of political fear or pressure from countries' powerful oligarchs.
Now, the leader of the rebels in Donetsk, Alexander Zakarchenko, has said that the fighting will continue until all the territory lost to Ukrainian forces last year is reclaimed. This is, of course, in defiance of the peace deal we saw back in September, which Moscow publicly supported. We're also now hearing that rebel leaders in Donetsk and Luhansk are refusing to attend talks with Ukraine in Belarus. Maxim, is there much hope in Kiev for a solution to all of this?
Again, because it's a political hostage from both sides, this conflict, there is kind of a reluctance to use all means necessary to stop this kind of violence. But Russia increased its logistic and military support for rebels exactly because of rising economic pressure on Ukraine. And frankly, Russia has more resources to hold on longer amid this economic storm than Ukrainians have. So I think it's a dramatic waiting game for both countries. And it's not a secret that Russia wants to preserve this kind of frozen conflict in eastern Ukraine to try to influence and pressure Ukraine time to time to change its course towards Europe and Western reintegration.
Now, you mentioned the pending default just a little bit earlier there. Ukraine, of course, has another dark cloud on its horizon with US $11 billion of debt due this year. The European Union is offering 1.8 billion euros while America is pledging US 2 billion. Does Ukraine really need more help from the outside world to stop it from falling under?
Ukraine needs much, much more help that it's there on the table at the moment. And it seems like IMF or any other country they are reluctant to provide more, again, because of not enough reforms inside of Ukraine. And defaulting of the country is very likely. Although, you know, political leaders are still denying that there is any possibility of Ukraine defaulting, which is obviously is not surprising. But the discussion among financial and economic elite is moved beyond the possibility of default to how to deal with its fallout or to make it more manageable and less damaging. There are a lot of talks of possible haircuts of Ukraine among Ukrainian investors. The same deal that Greece, for example, struggled to get for its economy stay on flow.
Maxim Eristavi there speaking to us from Kiev. Let's turn now to our studio guests, Jeffrey Kaufman and Mary Dajewski. Moscow, at least publicly, backed this peace plan, which now seems to be gone out the window. Another classic case of Moscow saying something in public but doing something very different in private.
I don't agree with that. I think that Moscow was saying something in public that it very much hoped would happen in private. And the influence, to my mind, of Moscow directly on the people who are called the rebels in eastern Ukraine, to my mind, is vastly exaggerated. And that's really the biggest problem with the peace deal, which is that Russia itself, either with or without Kiev, with or without the European Union, can't by itself enforce the solution. This has to be between Kiev and the rebels in the east, and this is simply not happening. I mean, we've seen that they've been invited to talks in Minsk, new talks in Minsk, and they've said they're not going. Well, you know, that's not really the best attitude to have if what you want is a peace deal.
But, I mean, if Maxim Eristavi is to be believed, there has been more Russian artillery crossing the border in recent weeks. Hardly the sign of an administration seeking to preserve what peace, little peace there was. Jeffrey?
Absolutely. I mean, I agree with Mary, though. I think that you know, Putin, as much as he's playing chess, did not anticipate that you know, I think Putin, in his vanity, perhaps, and his unimpeachability, was believed that he could control events. And of course, what we see in so many world events and so many of the events in the Middle East, for example, that we've talked about so often, is that careful what you start, because you just don't know where it's going to go. And I think these rebels really are renegade rebels, so to speak, and Putin has a lot of interest in trying to calm things down. He's got huge economic problems. We've talked before. Oil exports are 50% of the Russian economy. The drop in oil prices is catastrophic. He does not need this to spiral out of control any further. At the same time, you're right. Russian forces are massing. He's covering himself. He's got to, from his perspective, with his expansionist views in Crimea, he's got to cover his bases and make sure that his interests are protected. But he's got, you know, now he's got a multiplicity of adversaries. I think this is the key thing. He's got the Ukraine, he's got Western Ukraine and the Ukrainian government. He's got the rebels, and then he's got the West itself.
Mary, you wanted to come back in there.
Yes, I wanted to come back specifically on the matter of Donetsk Airport, because even though this looks like an actually small point, it's actually quite a big point, because Donetsk Airport, first of all, has colossal symbolism. It was a brand new state-of-the-art airport that was built when Poland and Ukraine jointly hosted the European Cup. And it's sort of tragic that something that was conceived as a symbol of, you know, friendship and modernity and all those things across that part of Europe has actually been shattered. And the reality, of course, has been shattered too. The second thing is that Donetsk Airport was a key part of the first peace agreement that was provisionally signed. And the idea was that the rebels would actually gain the territory of the airport in return for giving up some villages on the other side to the Kiev forces. This was actually mentioned by Putin approvingly in the speech that he gave, the State of the Nation address that he gave a few weeks ago in Moscow. And the interesting thing about that is that the rebels actually reneged on that agreement because they refused to give up the key villages, the territory that they were supposed to give up in exchange for the airport. And when they were challenged about that, they said, oh, we can't do that because we're frightened of what will happen to it's our relatives and our friends who live in those villages, and we're scared of what might happen to them if they're taken over by the forces from Kiev. So there was actually an agreement there that failed, and that's why it failed.
I want to come back to that point that both of you are making about Vladimir Putin's genuine strategy in all this and whether or not he actually does want to preserve the peace. I mean, no doubt he is in a economic quagmire on home ground, and, you know, a proxy war is probably the least of his worries right now. But isn't this all presuming that he is a rational thinker?
I think we've given up on that, to be honest. And you know, I was looking at this shelling of a bus outside of Donetsk the other day. 13 people died. And this disinformation campaign from Russia continues. If you want to make your blood boil, just go to RT, RussiaToday.com, RT.com, which is the mouthpiece of the Kremlin. It's their global propaganda channel. And they're doing what they did when the Malaysian airliner was shot down. They're saying, oh, the Americans have rushed to judgment and assume it was our shell. They're saying, you know, RT and the Kremlin are saying, don't, you know, we think it was the Ukrainians who did it to themselves to make us look bad. I mean, it's the most infantile. Even conspiracy theorists would have difficulty stomaching that.
The report, of course, has not been published.
What's that?
The report on the downing of the Malaysian airliner. And the provisional report was very, very cautious. It didn't attribute a blame to either side where the opportunity was there.
I can't imagine it'll be terribly cautious when the final report comes out.
I do want to make one point, and I thought that Maxim, the journalist, made an important point that's not getting much attention. And that is that you know, in the careful what you wish for department again, Crimea, if you look at the geography, just look at a map of Crimea, and you can see that Crimea itself is actually quite isolated from Russia. And what we're seeing now is that it's actually quite difficult to sustain it without the resources of Ukraine that it's now been severed from. And so this is a strategy that may help explain why Putin is moving forces in. He just doesn't have the transportation and energy resources to keep Crimea afloat without having access to Ukraine.
I want to make one other point, and I'll ask one other point about the military or the military strategy ahead of before we talk about the Ukrainian economy. But, you know, optimistically, if you're of a view that this perhaps conflict could come to an end fairly soon, could you see these recent maneuvers as jockeying for position, taking of strongholds before peace negotiations begin in earnest?
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, in a way, that is actually what's been going on for the best part of 3 months, possibly even 6 months, has been an attempt to maximise positions before what I think everybody pretty much recognises is the inevitable, some sort of solution. I'd also like to say that I absolutely disagree with the idea of Putin as irrational. I think it's hugely dangerous to treat any national leader, however ridiculous, absurd, illogical their judgments and decisions seem to be from abroad. I think they should be taken seriously, yeah. And that if we don't take them at face value, then we risk gigantic misinterpretations that could lead to something even more appalling than what's going
on
now.
In spite of his self-portraiture.
But well, I think that's fair. I think he's a master calculator. I would characterize him that way.
Okay, let's talk about the economy, the Ukrainian economy. When you consider all that Kyiv has endured to try to align itself with Europe, and then you look at what Europe has done in return when it comes to support and cold hard cash, it's not very much, is it?
It's not very much, and it's dire. The debt you talked about, there's a is it a $3 billion or $3 billion? I get so confused by the currency.
They're talking about a $15 billion shortfall.
There's a $3 billion, is it pound note that it's or euro?
I think
let's just call it $3
billion.
It's billions for now.
Whatever it is.
It doesn't matter.
Probably
it
doesn't.
It really doesn't
because
they can't pay.
They don't have it.
Yeah, well, you're right. Thank you. but the point is that Ukraine has been depleting its foreign currency reserves. They're half of where they were. I think they're down to 20 billion euro now. They were twice that a year ago. They can barely pay for gas and oil from the Russians, and they're using up their reserves. You can see them. You know, it's winter. It's cold. It's below freezing in Donetsk and across Ukraine, and people need heating oil to survive. And you can feel the squeeze happening.
And the finance minister, Natalia Yuresko, has come out effectively with the begging bowl, asking for money from Europe. Do you think, is there a danger that, Europe, by sitting on its hands, risks playing into Moscow's hands and, jeopardizing the support of those leaning towards the West in Ukraine?
Well, that's essentially what happened a year and a half ago when the then leader, Yanukovych, refused to sign the provisional agreement, the trade agreement with the European Union. And he did it because Moscow was actually offering far more money. And Ukraine was in an almost as dire situation then as it is now. And the problem with Ukraine and the reason why Europe is so reluctant to give them any more money is because there is a record of money that's been given to Ukraine being squandered. It's not husbanded this money very carefully. And people just, they look at it and say, well, why should we throw good money after bad? The problem is, of course, that Ukraine is now on the verge of going down the tubes if it doesn't get money.
Okay, Mary and Jeffrey there, we're going to have to leave it for the time being. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tadhg Enright. And after this break, we're going to continue our review of the day's news with Jeffrey Kaufman from ABC News and Mary Dajewski from The Independent. Next on our agenda, should the West respond to Al-Qaeda's attack on free speech with a clampdown on internet freedoms?
From her perch in Wan Chai, Aisha Spears is Monocle's Hong Kong bureau chief. Covering topics ranging from territorial disputes to urban upsets, the luxury goods sector to organic farming, Aisha Spears boasts one of the best beats at Monocle.
From the expanding political influence of Beijing to the growing economic power of Southeast Asia's middle class, we look at the people, businesses, and nations that are shaping the exciting Asia-Pacific region.
From Sukhumvit to Orchard Road, Aisha Spears is Monocle's woman in Hong Kong and beyond. Catch her reports and check-ins around the clock right here on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24. Now, today in Paris saw another, thankfully short-lived, hostage drama unfolding in the French capital, which is still reeling from the Charlie Hebdo attacks last week. The response from some European leaders is to perhaps perversely respond to Al-Qaeda's attack on free speech with a tightening of internet freedoms. At a meeting of foreign ministers, there was a joint call on internet publishers to self-censor their own content. Mary, what are your thoughts?
I think this is incredibly tricky because, of course, if you say that you want free speech for us and then you say, well, there can't be free speech for them, people like the imams who are called extremists, who are whipping up anti-Western sentiment, then it's hugely difficult because you can't go marching through Paris with 3 million people in favour of free speech and really determine where free speech stops. So I think there is a problem there.
Are you surprised, Jeffrey, by perhaps the naivety or the nature of this call so swiftly after, as we pointed out, the kind of the attack on free speech?
You know, the concept of free speech was conceived in an era so far from today, and I think the internet and sort of unbridled freedom of expression really tests those notions that are quite antique now. And you know, as a journalist and as someone who, you know, is a passionate advocate of freedom of speech, it's a very, I think Mary's right, this is a these are really difficult waters to navigate. You know, you look at Mark Zuckerberg, who spoke out against the mass at Charlie Hebdo, and yet at the same time is censoring the content on Facebook. And, you know, when you look at what's happening with these jihadists and how they're using the internet to cultivate jihadists and young people within in the West, in Europe and North America, to do these kind of, and Australia too, to do these kind of things, you can understand why there are calls to police this and to limit it. But then, you know, one of the most, I think you saw a couple of million people marching in Paris for freedom, and yet you've got, I think it's now 13 countries talking openly about restricting internet freedom in the wake of Charlie Hebdo. This is the ultimate irony of this event, and none more vigorously than Britain's own David Cameron, you know, who says if he's reelected, he will give the government more power to troll the internet, more power to snoop. And of course, all of that is fine when you're talking about jihadists who want to do bad things. But, you know, you have in this country also The Guardian and Edward Snowden. And is he, you know, is he, in David Cameron's view, also a terrorist? And you know, did The Guardian commit some sort of act of terrorism? This is, and I think Mary very eloquently put it, you know, this is the complexity. Where is the line? You know, and it's a bit sort of today's version of one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist.
You've got, of course, censorship in one corner, but then espionage in another. And another of the proposals which has come out today is, number one, that governments be allowed access to air itineraries. Goodness me, I thought they already would have had that. And also, David Cameron says he wants to force internet companies to allow governments to monitor encrypted data traffic. And do you think a sympathy would support for that, for such moves? Is it growing, waning in this current climate? I mean, obviously Edward Snowden revelations the last few years have raised many people's ire, but I mean, speaking personally, I don't mind if people are watching and reading my emails because I've got nothing to hide.
But that's a very, with all due respect, yeah, that's a kind of Mussolini-esque view of freedom. You know, if you have nothing to hide, you shouldn't be afraid. I'm sorry, I take deep exception to that approach to freedom. I have every right to my privacy. We all have moments in our lives that we don't want to share, or at least we don't want to share with the world. And I don't want some government snoop trolling through everything I send to my family and my friends.
But already you've got Google, for example, spying on everything I send via an email to my friends to see what they can sell me. So
You're right about that.
And as long as it's simply an algorithm checking to see if I'm planning on planting a bomb or something somewhere.
I think Mary, you go ahead.
There is a suggestion that some of this is generational, that, as it were, the younger generation is completely at peace with the idea that everybody's looking at everything, and then those of us a slightly different generation might have qualms about it. But I also think there's actually a transatlantic difference here, even though I'm together with an American.
Because Canadian, but that's okay.
Illustrates my point, because Canada, I think, would be on the European side here. But I was correspondent in Washington through the late 90s, and there was a colossal argument going on between the US and Europe about internet privacy, and about the Americans wanted the Europeans to guarantee that there would be something called a key access for the government, a sort of a backdoor key for every government to have, so that it would be able to access all websites and information, and it would be able to do this over and above all encryption. And the Europeans said no. And it's interesting to me that the Europeans have since then actually given quite a lot of ground on that. But the divide still stands. There is a transatlantic difference. And I would say that the Canadians are actually more towards Europe on this.
And the Brits are probably more with the United States.
Yes. And they also. And the idea that where the line, you know, again, we're looking at lines, where the line between your privacy and the government's right or obligation to produce security.
I think the challenge here for those who do think we all have the right to hide something is that this threat is so present and is so massive that it becomes very hard. There is no obvious solution to this that doesn't in some way compromise the values that we have historically cherished.
But doesn't it all really depend on what you are hiding? I mean, GCHQ, MI5 here in the UK doesn't care if you, I, or Mary are having an affair.
Yeah, but Edward Snowden, should he have been suppressed? Because Edward Snowden is a more less prurient but more important example. Edward Snowden, I think, told us a lot of very important things, and I think that he and the Guardian ultimately did a great service to our understanding of where freedom stands. But by the definitions that you're accepting, he could have been jailed. The Guardian could have been jailed or shut down. And, you know, the absurdity of The Guardian even then having to, take a hammer to its hard drives, knowing that copies of all that data were elsewhere in the world outside of the UK. I mean, this illustrates how difficult this is. You know, the notion of freedom has changed.
Well, it's a debate that won't be won or lost anytime soon. Unfortunately, we have run out of time, though. We'll have to leave it there. Jeffrey Kaufman and Mary Dajewski, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Orlando, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
We've got plenty still to come here in the second half of today's Midori House, including a check-in with our woman in Sao Paulo, that's Claire Rigby. Before we get started on that, though, Jonathan Weekly has the latest world news headlines.
Thank you very much. Belgian, French and German police have interrogated dozens of Islamist suspects today, as much of Europe remained on heightened security alerts after last week's killings in Paris and raids yesterday in Belgium, in which two gunmen were killed in Verviers. The Islamic State militant group is reported to have executed 15 people over the past 24 hours in Syria. Some of the victims were shot and crucified. In China, a search and rescue operation is still underway today after a boat capsized in the Yangtze River, leaving 22 people missing. And the South African president has asked Parliament to reconsider a bill giving the state a free 20% stake in gas and oil ventures, believing it might not survive a potential challenge that is unconstitutional, the South African government has said today. And that's latest news from Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. The time is 21:32, or it's almost 21:33 in Moscow, 18:33 here in London, 16:33 if you're listening in Rio de Janeiro. And it's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. We're going to Brazil today. Joining me from Sao Paulo is Monocle's Claire Rigby. Welcome to back to the programme as ever, Claire. Now, this should be the wettest time of the year in Brazil, but it's not.
Well, it's funny you should say that because it's raining right now, and this actually happens almost every day at this time, which is about 4:30 in the afternoon, 5 p.m. Yes, we have a dreadful, dreadful drought here in São Paulo, but we also have violent afternoon rainstorms, which is a strange set of affairs.
And if, you know, you're suffering from a shortage of rain, why don't those violent storms in the evening sort out the reserves?
I think it's too little too late. We've had, this is a summer rainstorm. It always happens this time of year. They're always, as I say, at roughly the same time of the afternoon. Very violent, but they sweep across the city quite quickly. And a lot of lightning, a lot of kind of drama and high winds, and very cold wind, actually, despite the very hot temperatures here. but they're just not enough. And, you know, the ground's very, very dry. The city is covered with concrete, which doesn't help, so a lot of the water evaporates. So I think they mitigate the situation a tiny bit, but we have much less rain at this point in the year than we should have. It's about 22% of what we should be having for this time of year.
So how are the people of Sao Paulo coping?
Well, it depends who you talk to. So I think, you know, in a lot of the more built-up areas, most of the time so far, people who live in apartment buildings, which is, you know, the vast majority of people in the main sort of part of Sao Paulo, central Sao Paulo, most people are managing okay so far. They tend to have quite large water tanks in those buildings, so that even when there are shortages, it isn't always immediately obvious. The people who are really suffering, as always, are the people in the periphery, the people who live kind of further out and who live in houses. They suffer much quicker. You know, the water is being severely rationed at the moment, and they notice that straight away. And I think people as well who don't have water tanks in their homes also suffer the most because they've got nowhere to store water.
How regular an occurrence is this in Sao Paulo? I mean, you know, are bad droughts a once in every 10-year occurrence, or is this a newish phenomenon that has people wondering about things like climate change?
I think it's rare here in Sao Paulo. I was just talking to somebody today who lives in Zona Leste, which is very sort of far out, far-flung area to the east of Sao Paulo, a very poor area. And she was telling me about the problems they're facing out there. And I asked her, do you remember this happening before? She's 18 years old, this girl. She said she didn't remember anything. And her mother's been living in Sao Paulo 32 years, never remembered anything like it. And out there, they've spent almost the last 2 months with very little water. The water comes in at night, overnight. There's no water at all during the day. I think in terms of what people are worried about here, that certain people do certainly talk about global warming and such, but more importantly, at least, you know, in immediate terms here, people are very, very angry at the state government for having failed to address this much sooner and for failing to invest in infrastructure or to kind of, you know, put in place any preventative measures to, you know, to ensure that this couldn't have got to this stage.
And talking of infrastructure, Claire, you know, based on the nature of a city that Sao Paulo is and the varying people, you know, people of varying income levels and housing standards, is there a concern about public health, perhaps disease, given that some people are going without running water for some periods of the day?
You know, that hasn't really been so far part of the story, but I think you're quite right that at any moment now that's going to become part of the story because, you know, again, I was chatting to a restaurant owner who is without water every afternoon, and actually, you know, probably wrongly, I was too polite to ask him how on earth, you know, they're managing, and I'd actually been sent there by a customer, and I did say to that customer, how on earth are they doing washing up? You know, there's obviously serious problems, you know, around the corner, as you say, and people are talking already of like washing up, rotting in the sink, you know, they cook their food, and by the time they finish eating, there's no water left to wash it. But
okay.
Yeah, it's a time bomb.
Claire Rigby in Sao Paulo, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks as ever for joining us here on Midori House. You're listening to Monocle 24. Up next, we're going to delve into the world of Arab animated satire.
Miami was all washed up, but then a brand new breed of art galleries and a boatload of art collections sailed in. Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound finds out how this big bad city turned into a bright-eyed and bushy-tailed art town.
There's warm weather art here, sure, and flesh on show. Why not? And there's the saleable big, bright and bold, but there's good art for sale too. Things that mean things. This city's become a magnet.
Son of a Beach, the Miami art scene. Now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
You're back with Midori House. I'm Tig Enright. Now, since last week's Charlie Hebdo attack, there has been much debate about free speech and what limits should apply to it. Cartoonists in the Arab world have been having their say too. Jonathan Guyer is a Fulbright Fellow researching political cartoons in Egypt, and he's also the associate editor of the Cairo Review of Global Affairs. Monocle's associate producer, David Pleasant, spoke to Jonathan to discuss a deeply complex visual debate.
Of course, Arab cartooning is a vast field. There's hundreds of cartoonists working across the Middle East. But generally speaking, Arab and Muslim cartoonists have strongly condemned the murder at Charlie Hebdo. And part of the reason is that cartooning is a dangerous profession in the Middle East. So many cartoonists here viscerally feel a connection to their French counterparts and know all of the risks and perils that come along with the profession. Of course, there has been nuance. Many cartoonists have found the space to criticize cartoons of the Prophet, cartoons that insult Islam and Arabs, while also saying that such killing is strictly unacceptable.
And we saw a small group of cartoonists in Cairo show their support and condolences in public, raising their pens, as many other cartoonists and the public have done all over the world. We saw those images of that group. I mean, how dangerous and what kind of a stance was that to make? I mean, presumably in a country with strong blasphemy laws, that was quite a risk.
To some extent, it's a risk, but in reality, the leading Islamic institutions here in Cairo have strongly condemned the killings while questioning what it is to have free speech and severely criticizing these images of the Prophet. So for cartoonists here in Cairo, the risk isn't so much standing in support of their French counterparts. Of course, Egyptian officials marched alongside global leaders in Paris last week. The bigger risk pertains to what it is to draw every day in Egypt, where the events are always changing, where censorship is never so clear, where an artist never knows if he or she has gone too far until they get a phone call from an officer or are censored or sued or a variety of tactics of intimidation.
And what do you think, what kind of impact do you think the Paris attacks are going to have on the life and work of an Egyptian or an Arab cartoonist going forward? Do you think it's going to, is there a certain amount of solidarity for them, or is it going to kind of harden the grip against the freedom of speech, or does it entirely depend on the day and on the political situation of the time?
Certainly the response to the Charlie Hebdo attacks has been ambiguous. Of course, the official cartooning syndicate here in Cairo, as well as the cartooning club in Baghdad, harshly condemned the attacks. So there's no equivocal nature about the attacks. That is something that, you know, no one would stand for here in the Middle East. However, it's raised all sorts of questions about what are the root causes of terrorism? What are the legacies of colonialism? What does xenophobia in France mean for Muslims across the Middle East? And these questions are going to take years to unpack, and I think what we'll see is that cartoonists will continue to draw every day about these issues and slowly unravel them.
In your foreign policy article, you very eloquently describe the reaction of one particular Egyptian cartoonist, Andil, who you mention. And this is someone who's very prolific, very vociferous, even in the darkest, most terrible times. But he has remained silent. Maybe tell us a little bit about what he had to say when you met him.
Sure. I sat with Andil a couple days ago in a little cafe in Cairo. And he's very active on social media. So his first reaction was he didn't want to draw a predictable cartoon of a pen versus a gun. Andil, the young Egyptian cartoonist, he wanted to start a conversation with his 45,000 Facebook followers and say, you know, what does it mean to be a Muslim? For those who call themselves moderate Muslims, what does this mean? He posted this very controversial cartoon from The Onion, the American satirical magazine, that was blaspheming all sorts of religions and asking, why didn't The Onion get attacked, but Charlie Hebdo got attacked? And Andil has yet to draw something over a week later. And it goes to the nuance that many cartoonists are pondering is how do you have a response to something so tragic in an attack on the very art form, the very career of cartooning itself, without falling into a cartoonish narrative of black and white, good and evil? Because, of course, none of the issues raised by the Paris attacks are so black and white.
And then there were some other well-known cartoonists who did, in a nuanced way, they did respond graphically. Maybe visually talk us through some of their responses.
Sure. Every Arab cartoonist across the Middle East has drawn something in response. One comic artist in Cairo drew himself attacking the gunmen who killed the Paris cartoonists. You know, some have been making fun of ISIS and extremism through really silly gags. I mean, there's just been a huge variety. Some look very similar to the cartoons we've seen in Britain and the US. Others are very irreverent, dark humor, a masked gunman beheading Charlie Hebdo. So this is one thing that sets the Middle East apart, is there's really this gallows humor, these black jokes that I find in the West are often absent after a tragedy. But Arab cartoonists, who are intimately familiar with the risks of the art form, are often willing to go further in their really dark commentary on events.
And if I can just finally quote you, you say, you ask the question, you know, the West is often asking, where are moderate Muslims? And according to you, they're drawing, they're the cartoonists. Do you think that's set to continue?
Absolutely. Of course, cartooning is not a monolithic field. There's Islamists, there's conservatives, there's revolutionaries, there's men and women. But of course, there's this huge contingent of what we might call moderate Muslims, cartoonists who believe strongly in free speech, cartoonists who question their faith, cartoonists who question every thread of politics and governments. And that's why I found cartooning just the most fascinating field to understand what people in the Arab world think, you know, on a day-to-day, moment-to-moment basis. Because that's what cartoons do. They react to the most disturbing parts of the news that need to be addressed today.
Jonathan Guy there, speaking to Monocle's David Pleasant. Still ahead here on Midori House, we'll be hearing from Isabel Stevens from the British Film Institute's magazine about some upcoming releases to keep an eye on, including that controversial Oscar snub for Selma, which has many up in arms. So let's hear from the soundtrack of Selma now. This is Common and John Legend with the Oscar-nominated track Glory. Common and John Legend there with Glory. That's nominated for Best Original Song at this year's Oscars. It is, of course, the soundtrack to the upcoming movie Selma. And that segues us neatly into our daily arts review here on Midori House. With Oscar season upon us, what better time to catch up with the latest on the silver screen? Monocle's Ben Ryland spoke to Isabel Stevens from the British Film Institute's magazine about some coming attractions and a rather controversial Oscar snub.
First up, Isabel, let's talk about Selma. This is, of course, the much-anticipated film that chronicles Martin Luther King's march from the town of Selma, Alabama, to Montgomery, the year after the signing into law of the Civil Rights Act 1964. We've got a little clip from the trailer. Let's have a listen.
He's got supporters. Detroit, New York, Los Angeles, inciting large-scale arrests and sympathy marches.
I'm very aware of that, Mr. Hoover. What I do know is he's nonviolent. What I need to know right now, what's Martin Luther King about to do next?
Mr. President, Dr. King is here.
Now, movies with this kind of subject matter often face mammoth expectations, and Selma, of course, has already been criticised for its depiction of President Lyndon Johnson as someone who begrudgingly went along with the civil rights movement. Isabel, what was your take?
I think it's unfortunate that they did have to amplify his role in that. Ideally, I think they wouldn't have done that just for dramatic purposes, but I do think it's a biopic and that generally with those kind of films, people do take a bit of liberty. I do also think it's a very important film. I don't think it's a story that many people are aware of. I think the performances are amazing. It's also a film by a black female director. And there aren't very many of those around, sadly. But most of all, it's a very well-directed film, which actually came as a bit of a surprise for me because I thought as it was being sort of talked up for all these Oscars that it would just be a sort of another biopic film. But it's a very interesting biopic because it focuses on a very small part of Martin Luther King's life. And it is very quite experimental in the way that it films the protests, particularly the violence that erupts out of them.
It's interesting that 12 Years a Slave, when that was released fairly recently, it was hailed as the definitive film to go to about slavery. Do you think that Selma will become the go-to film about the civil rights movement?
I hope not, because I hope there'll be more films about the civil rights movement to come. But I do think it's a very important one, particularly as it comes off the back of a lot of sad events in the United States, such as the brutal police treatment of people in Ferguson and Staten Island. So I think, you know, it would always be sort of quite a landmark film in that respect. And I think sort of people will look back in 20 years' time and think, well, why wasn't she nominated for an Oscar? But most of, you know, the Oscars, and as are most awards, are often sort of quite behind the times, I think.
Yeah, it does seem that the Oscars are a little bit out of touch on this one. It has a 99% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, yet it was only nominated for Best Picture and Best Original Song. Do you think the Academy is out of touch by missing out on this one?
I think it is, yes. I think the fact that most of the Academy voters are sort of white male obviously plays into that. It's a shame, really, that it could be a really groundbreaking film in that respect. I mean, it already is, but it could become much more well known to a wider range of people if it did get that platform at the Oscars, which I'm hoping that it wins Best Picture. But it would be amazing if Ava DuVernay, you know, could have gone up there and picked up the Best Director award.
Let's move on to the new film from director Paul Thomas Anderson now, Inherent Vice. Here's a little sample.
If it's a quiet night out at the beach and your ex-old lady suddenly out of nowhere shows up with a story about her current billionaire land developer boyfriend and his wife and her boyfriend and a plot to kidnap the billionaire and throw him in a loony bin.
I need your help, Doc.
Maybe you should just look the other way. But if you're Doc, it may all start to get a little peculiar after that.
Michael Z. Wolfman.
And Mickey Wolfman.
And Mickey Wolfman.
Has vanished.
So where would I find him?
He's technically Jewish, but wants to be a Nazi.
And a girl don't necessarily want to get into difficulties with those folks.
You got a spare picture I can borrow?
Now, The New Yorker had a wonderful line in its review about this one, which said, "Nobody has ever turned a Thomas Pynchon book into a movie before for the same reason that nobody has managed to cram the New York Philharmonic into a Ford Focus." Now, just going by the trailer, this seems like quite a deranged vision. Isabel, what was your take on it?
It is very deranged. It's very weird. It's also very funny. I wasn't expecting it to be quite so funny as it is. It's got an amazing cast, from Joaquin Phoenix to Owen Wilson, Reese Witherspoon, Benicio del Toro, all these actors coming at you sort of in guises and characters that you're not really expecting. It's not a film that's about anything. It's quite different, much less portentous than Anderson's last two films, There Will Be Blood and The Master. It's much more similar in tone to Punch Drunk Love or Boogie Nights, this film about the porn industry. It's just quite a strange film in that it takes you to lots of different places. You know, one moment it's about drug smuggling, the next minute it's about crazy dentists. There's lots of missing people. And Joaquin Phoenix plays this stoner private detective. He sort of wakes up next to a corpse and then somehow gets embroiled in this case that he's working on. And the police sort of start suspecting him. It's sort of like about conspiracy theories, but it's, I suppose, the main element of it is the sort of souring of the hippie dream. It really sort of has quite a dark side to it. It's much more similar to sort of many of the noirs from the 1970s, like Chinatown. And I think that people that will go into it just expecting a comedy might be a little bit surprised. It's a lot darker than the trailer sort of makes you think about.
Now, we last saw Joaquin Phoenix starring in the wonderful film Her from last year, which scored a Best Picture nomination. How does he fare in Inherent Vice?
He is very good. He looks the part, thanks to Paul Anderson and his team of his production team, who just make the 70s look fantastic and look quite different and a bit grimier than many other depictions of them in film recently. His performance is great because it's sort of so rattled, and you just really get the sense of him being this kind of sort of stoner who's really out of, like, slightly out of sync with everything that's going on at the moment.
Isabel Stevens there from the British Film Institute, speaking to Monocle's Ben Rylan. That, unfortunately, is all we have time for on today's Midori House. Thanks go in particular to our special guests, Jeffrey Kaufman from America's ABC News and Mary Dajewski from the Independent newspaper here in London. Today's show was produced by Ben Rylan. It was researched by David Pleasant and Claire Lancaster. Our studio manager was Bill Lutie. Next up, after the headlines, it's The Menu with Marcus Hippie. Then at 2200 hours here in London, time for the Monocle Daily for another dose of news and current affairs. This show will be back at the same time on Monday. That's 1800 hours if you're listening here in London. But for me, for this edition of Midori House, I've been your host, Ty Genwright. It's goodbye and thank you for listening.